Do you remember listening to the radio for the first time? I don't mean just hearing it in the background, in the kitchen as your parents prepared the evening meal, maybe laughter drifting through the room. I mean really listening. The moment you realised there was something entrancing about radio itself. For me, that moment came when I was 12. I'd just rescued an old Bakelite radio set and installed it next to my bed. It was night time. My right ear was pressed hard against the cloth-covered loudspeaker, so the volume could be down low and I could evade discovery. In the darkness, I was transfixed by a small, round, blood-red bulb fixed to the dial. It pulsated into glowing life, decayed into invisibility, then into life again, as I spun through the frequencies to catch the faint chatter of humanity. Strangely accented voices drifted in and out of the electromagnetic swell. Voices from Paris, Hilversum, Rome. Sometimes voices from the other side of the Iron Curtain. Radio Tirana, Radio Moscow, Radio Peking. I can't remember what they said. It didn't matter. What mattered was that as they spoke, I listened. For those moments, I was connected to someone 5,000 miles away. Back then, in the 1970s, my sense of witnessing magic sprang from childlike innocence. Go back another three quarters of a century, to the years when radio was new, and it didn't just strike children as magical. Writers, artists and scientists, or ordinary men and women drawn to a new household gadget. Wherever I've dug up their first impressions, I found a sense of wonder. The distances travelled, the invisibility of the waves. It felt to them as if the world had changed in all sorts of ways. I wish we could recapture this feeling. Because 100 years ago, our worldview, the way we thought, shifted. An example of how something as taken for granted and everyday as the radio set in our kitchen or the TV set in our sitting room can slowly rewire our minds. One key moment, a December day in 1901. It was then that the engineer and canny businessman Guglielmo Marconi sent that famous first-ever message by wireless across the Atlantic. Now, the dots and dashes of Morse code had been pulsating along undersea cables for decades. As for sending signals through the air without wires, scientists had cracked that too. In August 1894, the British physicist Oliver Lodge had sent a letter S flying through the air between two lecture theatres in Oxford. But having done the science, Lodge moved on. The young Marconi, however, sensed a commercial opportunity. If only he could make wireless cross whole oceans. Physicists more highly trained than Marconi believed its signal could only ever travel in a straight line. The Earth was curved. As the eminent Lord Rayleigh put it, wireless faced the small problem of a mountain of water 100 miles high to be got over. Marconi was unperturbed. Leaving orders in Cornwall for the letter S to be transmitted in Morse at regular intervals, he travelled by steamer to Newfoundland. What happened next, we can glean from his diary. Wednesday. Signals appeared at intervals. Dots threatened to appear on the tapper. Thursday. 1 hour of reception. Better than yesterday. So far, no signal was strong enough to distinguish itself from the thick soup of normal atmospheric crackle. Marconi desperately needed a result. He attached a telephone receiver to the wireless set to amplify it and got his two assistants to confirm that, yes, they too could hear a distinct series of faint clicks. For Marconi, this was enough. The horizon had fallen to wireless. The whole world lay at the mercy of this new technology. At this point in the story, it's common to conjure up Marshall McLuhan. To conclude with him that here was a new medium making the world a smaller, more interconnected place. A global electronic village. That's not what I see when I look at what was written in the years after Marconi's stunt. Take one of the Edwardian era's popular science magazines, Wireless World. Every month from April 1913, Wireless World offered its 20,000 readers, mostly men and boys, snippets of news about the derring-do of wireless pioneers. instruction on how to build receivers and erect aerials, adverts for new bits of kit or training courses in wireless telegraphy, short stories, travelogues. You could drown in articles about ships sinking. Ships foolish enough not to have been equipped with wireless. Hundreds of lives lost without hope of rescue. Fear and anxiety stalk the pages of Wireless World. Stories of old-fashioned telegraph wires being destroyed by wild weather in far-flung places, of wretched people left isolated, waiting anxiously for contact with the outside, and, as the world edged towards war, constant talk of national danger. Its short stories outdid William Le Queux's monstrously chauvinistic best-selling tales of German invasion. Dastardly foreign spies with hidden transmitters or remote control airships, capable of raining down fire on innocent Britons. Wireless World liked war, or the threat of war, with wireless an exciting, vital part of the arms race, a branch of national service. I've got in front of me the cover of a Wireless World from 1913. It shows a jagged white streak encircling the globe. It's made up of Morse code and spells out the word Marconi. Wireless World was, yes, the house magazine of the Marconi Company, a weapon in its campaign for dominion in the ether. If any of this changed how the Edwardians thought about their place in the world, it wasn't in comforting electronic villagey ways. Radio stations sprang up in godforsaken outposts of empire, but they weren't about getting to know this new world. Wireless gave us a new sensory prosthesis. We could reach out and touch foreign cultures, but rarely did we engage with them or value them. In Wireless World, we read about the brave Marconi pioneers stationed in desolate places such as Accra or Aden, erecting their equipment in hot and dusty buildings, plagued by white ants or mosquitoes, served by natives who are lazy or incompetent or thieving, bringing civilization to an uncivilized world. This was travel that narrowed the mind. The mental universe of wireless was remarkably self-centered, unleashing a kind of cognitive imperialism. It all sounds very dystopian. But there were people who saw in wireless something more liberating, if a little uncanny. It was, after all, invisible. Its messages floated free from the material constraints of cables and human bodies. This fascinated writers such as Rudyard Kipling. In 1902, he published a short story called, simply, Wireless. It's a strange tale, set in a chemist's shop on the south coast at night time. Inside, a young wireless enthusiast is trying, unsuccessfully, to pick up a message transmitted from across the bay. With him is a consumptive apothecary drugged up on a chloroform cocktail, who enters a kind of trance and starts burbling the words of a poem by Keats, scribbling down sentences like a human Morse code receiver, possessed. There's something coming through from somewhere, the wireless operator shouts. But in this momentary connection, the hoped-for message has gone astray. The one that arrives is unbidden. How long Keats's spirit had been adrift, why or how the connection had been made, is unclear. But wireless had somehow cracked open the ether, revealing it to be teeming with unheard noise competing for attention. Kipling's story rang true because as more and more radio transmitters pumped their electromagnetic dots and dashes, and later voices, into the atmosphere, people reported unsettling phenomena. A crackling cake tin in England, a singing coal shovel in Sweden, a tin roof in Ohio that made political speeches and occasionally burst into song. People's first brush with a disembodied voice could shake them to their core. It's no surprise that the Edwardians thought of wireless as a ghost trick, like bringing back the dead. When Kipling wrote his wireless story, his young daughter Josephine had just died. He sometimes imagined he'd seen her as a radiance lurking in his garden. The link between science and spiritualism fascinated physicists and philosophers. Both activities lifted a veil on the world of invisible forces just beyond the senses. The connective tissue that permeated this universe and linked the two worlds of faith and reason was the ether, a usefully vague entity, attractive to those who missed the old certainties of orthodox religion and wanted a new kind of transcendence. It also seemed to make hard-headed science fall into place. It was the medium, perhaps, which enabled sound and light to travel, just as water carries the waves of the sea. It didn't seem too far a stretch of the imagination to see it as a medium through which thought itself could escape the mundane limits of the human frame. Soon, science fiction was rife with stories of thought-ray machines controlling minds from afar. In Italy, the futurist Marinetti honed his fascist thinking by contemplating radio's ability to send commands across vast stretches of territory in a flash. Throughout the First World War, Wireless World reported German wireless stations radiating vast floods of false news reports, which spread through the ether like a virus as they were rebroadcast by other stations and then treated as fact by credulous newspapers. Reading these faded reports, I feel an intimation of the internet, our own vector for gossip. Back then, one British correspondent only half-joked when he called for the immediate invention of a device to filter out untruths and saturate the ether instead with truth ions. His plan was at the moderately unhinged end of a broader idea: to claim the ether not for totalitarianism, but for the transmission of sweet reason. This medium straddled and bathed the globe, connecting everyone, an ocean of dispersed thought in which perhaps anyone might go fishing for enlightenment. By 1922, we find a utopian counterblast to Marconi's Wireless World, in the form of a new magazine, The Broadcaster. Here, we read of a world just round the corner where radio would bring music and dancing to airliners, ships and homes, and bring voices to the silent cinema. It would make the world less lonely, less boring, less hard. In short, it would make for a happier world, or perhaps a more rational and peaceful one. This, at least, was the hope of one man who'd spent the war monitoring German wireless messages and then run a radio station at the League of Nations in 1920. Arthur Burroughs was among the first to use the word broadcasting. This new wonder had a great ideal at its heart: spreading throughout the world a doctrine of common sense. He spoke as the director of programmes at a new organisation, the BBC. When we look back at this early media revolution, we usually see the telegraph and wireless making the world smaller, more knowable. But there's another, more psychological history to be found, where wireless stirred up ideas about the nature of thought itself and how our minds might be shaped for good or ill. Wireless played its part in what Walter Benjamin called a phantasmagoria of the interior. It was a new kind of magic which carried old ideas of mesmerism and telepathy into the 20th century. It helped us think about the transmission of intelligence, how the public mind, as it was starting to be called, might be rewired by the media, how it might be made ready for the modern age, or indeed how the modern age might overwhelm and control it. The public mind was up for grabs. But rewiring's complicated. Ask an electrician. Amateurs interfere. Professionals fall out over which wiring scheme to adopt. It rarely goes exactly to plan.